When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, February 23rd, the Milo versus Lena edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have the June Thomas.
The June
elevated
Thomas.
June Thomas. JT, now managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Are you our boss now?
Hannah, nobody will ever be your boss. But yeah. I just want to point out at Slate, there's only one official JT, and that is our leader, Julia Turner. Mm. I'm just like JT2 maybe even JT3, but not JT.
All right. And the lowly Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hello.
Hi, Noreen. Just to build you back up, I got to say, I loved your Phoebe Waller-Bridge profile. We've talked about her. She's the Fleabag lady. And I was really jealous that you got to hang out with her.
She was really fun. And if people haven't seen Fleabag yet, please watch it. It's so good.
You know, I saw a picture of her in the Star Wars movie photo, and I was like, what is Fleabag doing in the which, of course, is, I guess, an awful insult to her, given that she, I'm sure, is a very, you know, versatile actress. But somehow she's so associated for me with that character that it seems incongruous, but awesome.
Yeah, it'll be cool to see.
Is she going to be your friend now? That's really what I want to know.
And then can she be our friend? No.
We'll work on it.
All right. So our topics today, Milo Yiannopoulos, right-wing provocateur who reached his peak this week and then plummeted off all in the same week. Second is Girls is back for its last season. We hope you've been watching. We talk about the show and its legacy. And finally, we talk about a former Uber employee's claims that the company is very sexist. Then in our Slate Plus segment, we talk about whether the particular way that liberals and the media are criticizing the women of Trump world is sexist. All right. Milo Yiannopoulos. We actually chose this topic before we knew this was going to be the week of Milo Yiannopoulos. So we got a lot to talk about. He is a provocateur who's been on what he calls the dangerous faggot tour. He on college campuses, in which he goes to college campuses and gets students to stand up against liberal thuggery, as he calls it. And he's been doing this for a while. He's a writer for Breitbart, the alt-right press.
He was a writer. He got fired.
Oh, sorry. He was. Right. That's right. He was a writer for Breitbart until, like, this week when he says he didn't get fired. In his press conference, he says that they were very nice to him and he decided to step down. Anyway, we're going to talk about all of this, what happened to him, how he kind of rose and then flamed out, basically for defending pedophilia. Let's start, though, first with who Milo Yiannopoulos is before we get into what happened to him this week. I have been listening to the Milo Yiannopoulos podcast. I've been reading his writing on Breitbart. He's a Brit. We get these every once in a while. June. A Brit who comes to America in order to explain to us who we really are and why we have strayed from that purpose. In his case, it's free speech, right? That's one thing that he is. He's many things, but that's one thing that he is. So which one of you wants to take this up and talk about the kinds of things that he's been doing over the last couple of years?
Well, so he is, I think, widely credited with, in some ways, bringing the alt-right, as it's called, into the, quote, mainstream. And by mainstream, I think in this context, we really mean Breitbart, or we did mean Breitbart. And then obviously, in the last few months of the election and afterwards, everyone's been talking about the alt-right. But he's young.
Wears really nice suits.
Right. He's a dandy.
He doesn't wear them very well, but whatever.
He's a dandy, and every photo that's taken of him, he seems to ask for clothing credits, you know, like shoes by Prada or whatever. He is, I don't want to say flamboyantly gay, maybe performatively gay is more accurate. And he criticizes all the usual targets. He hates women. I think it's easy to say that. He hates minorities.
He doesn't say that.
Well,
he does not.
But everything
that
he
as a
says indicates that he hates women. But so
no, okay, except for one thing. One thing. He'll say he hates lesbians. That's for sure.
And feminists.
And feminists. He definitely hates lesbians and feminists. He says that all the time. He hates fat people. He really believes in fat shaming. He says that all the time. He really hates Leslie Jones. He's responsible for bringing the army of trolls against her, which was a truly, truly vile moment.
Although
in his
he denies that too, but yes, but it's still nevertheless true.
He basically called her a gorilla, right? Yeah. He's super bad on race. Just like he talks a lot about how he has sex with black men, but he also says incredibly racist things sometimes about the men that he says he has sex with. It's like very complicated.
And yet, not so complicated.
Not so complicated. I mean, it's interesting. He thinks of himself as like a provocateur. He keeps saying, "I'm a comedian," and people don't understand the joke. And the wave he's riding here is the wave of comedians who say that they've been silenced. Like, everybody's interested in this, right? Like, I can't try at my jokes anymore. People are so sensitive. I used to try at my jokes on college campuses. The odd thing about that is that he's not actually funny.
No,
like, when you listen. I don't mean like it's not funny, Milo. I mean, he's not funny. Like, so when he makes a joke on a college campus, it falls totally flat. There's like a really awkward silence because I've listened to a bunch of his talks now and he doesn't understand the structure of a joke in any way. So that as a defense is really not. He's just tapping into that strain of like you, and this is a big kind of thing. This is one strain of the alt-right that he writes about a lot. Like, we're just having fun. You guys are the buzzkills. Like, we're this counterculture, you know, 4chan, 2chan, 8chan. Like, you build a statue, we knock it down. Like, we're just having fun here, guys.
And that's the thing that is most irritating to me about him. That he is a troll, which is something that he himself admits. And he keeps repeating, I'm fun, I'm attractive, I'm funny, and I'm, you know, just an entertainer. And the thing about him is, he is not funny, he is not entertaining, he is not witty. And so often, the people who he is pillaring in the most unimaginative way possible. I mean, is there anything more pathetic than just putting a picture of a person on a screen and then saying, look how ugly they are, which is kind of a big part of his act, as far as I can tell. And one of the people he mocks and, you know, has endless ha-ha fun with is Lena Dunham, who, if you watch her show, is fucking hilarious and is clever and is witty and is making points on a way that he thinks he is, and he just isn't. There's nothing about him. He possesses not a lick of wit in his entire body.
But he knows that people hate Lena Dunham.
Yes, he does.
And so in some ways smart of him. He can't make an original joke to save his life. His whole joke about feminists is that they're fat and no one wants to have sex with them. Yeah. And that's an original one, right?
That was originally 1975.
But people, a lot of people want like an outlet for making fun of Lena Dunham and Amy Schumer and this whole other, you know, a whole wide set of people who are not just white lady comedians. Yeah. And he gives them cover for that. I mean, it's interesting. Like, would we feel differently about Milo if he were actually funny? He would be in some ways more dangerous, right?
Like, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
And there is like a version of him out there that is more dangerous. But then like comedians that I like say on PC things, right? But it doesn't come from a place of like there's just no layer really between his hatred and the quote unquote jokes that he makes. There's no like complication there.
Exactly. There's no nuance. It's just ha ha. He's a 12-year-old. It's all schoolyard humor, which, you know, we all laughed at in the schoolyard. So, yeah, points for that. You will occasionally, you know, get a huh. But
I don't think that's what he's tapping into, though. Like, it's not just the making fun of people. He is, like, the one thing he really, when you, the speech after, the kind of question after question on the college campus, now you know how deeply into these podcasts I've been listening, are about the free speech stuff. It's like, I've been silenced. I can't say this. I'm not allowed to say this. It is about, that's the kind of bait he puts out, which I would say the campus left just like totally rises to falls into his trap every single time. Like he just baits them and says like, you know, the sort of words are violence movement on campuses is what he is the thing that people ask him about and want to know about. And, you know,
but that's the thing that I agree and I actually think on some level he is almost accidentally, I think, making a point about freedom of speech, that freedom of speech means freedom to say vile, horrible, repulsive things. But again, the speeches that I've read and heard, he's not saying anything. Right. He's not pushing any boundaries. He's just saying, I can't say things. Well, what do you want to say, bro? You got an audience here. All you're saying is Muslims are horrible, feminists are fat and ugly, and I like to suck black dick. I mean, that's all he says.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not as deep into the Milo world as you are. Maybe there are other things that he says.
Well, but to me, the interesting thing about the free speech argument is that, you know, his downfall almost gave lie to it, right? Not his own belief in free speech absolutism, but the people who were defending him clearly didn't actually, like, their main principle wasn't free speech because it's like free speech unless you say something that offends me. Mm-hmm. So the rest of what he was saying didn't offend them enough to upset them. But then he, you know, made a similarly awful remark about pedophilia and he was canceled from CPAC. People were out. He was out from Breitbart. So that was really instructive in, you know, what maybe people are using free speech to cover up.
Let's slow down and explain exactly what happened. So the Conservative Political Action Conference is exactly what it sounds. It meets every year, but it's more, you know, it's less of the libertarian Breitbart Milo school and more of the traditional conservative family values school. I mean, it's a tent, so it includes all those people, but it is definitely more kind of straight up family values. They invited him. He was on the Bill Maher show. So it felt like a moment when, as Noreen said, he was being accepted into the wider, more mainstream conservative Republican world, plus his book deal, et cetera, et cetera. And then somebody surfaces this video in which he's talking about his own experience in which it's clear that he as a young teenager, meaning 13 or 14, had sex or some kind of sexual encounter, definitely blowjob, with a priest, Father Michael, who he calls by name. And it seems from, if you watch the video, he's like squirming in this video. It's true. Like, he's not being theatrical. Like, this is something that actually happened. And he talks about it in several different ways. And then he says,
we get hung up on this sort of child abuse stuff to the point where we're heavily policing consensual adults. In the homosexual world, some of these relationships between younger boys and older men, the sort of coming-of-age relationship in which these older men help these young boys discover who they are and give them security and safety and provide them with love and a sort of rock where they can't speak to their parents. This totally freaked the conservatives out, as you said. Like, that just put them over the top. Like, they could accept, they kind of opened their tent enough for, like, a manly, libertarian, theatrically gay Brit, but not for one who says this about, you know, young teenagers and boys. Now, June, you sent around this great article by Nathan Robinson in Current Affairs, which I think is the best mm-hmm. analysis of all the hypocrisy involved in sort of throwing him over. Did you guys watch the press conference by any chance that he gave?
I did not.
I didn't.
It's really interesting because weirdly, this is the only time I feel like he's being actually honest and mm-hmm. not just kind of wildly theatrically provocative. Mm-hmm. He begins the press conference by saying, oh, maybe this is the reason I am, like, I was a victim, which is a kind of language he can't stand, this kind mm-hmm. of, like, emotional mm-hmm. truth, my emotional truth. I was a victim. This happened to me. I mean, he's all over the place. I'm not saying this is consistent, but this is the way, this might be the way I am what I am, how I am. I cope with this by telling dumb jokes about it all the time. He says he has a bad, you kind of read between the lines to think his family wasn't that down, or at least his father with his being gay.
Nor his stepfather.
So he makes it seem like this genuinely was true for him. And as Nathan Robinson writes, this is a dynamic that happens sometimes with young gay teenagers, which is part of the experience, but a part of the experience that no one's allowed to talk about, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. pedophilia. It is,
well,
pedophilia.
Or pederasty. Legally.
Pederasty. And legally, that's what it is. And yet it's a certain part of the experience for some gay boys. So he is just talking about that. And then he goes into his Milo shtick at the end of the press conference, like, screw you all. You know, I'm just going to be bigger and bad. Like the Trump side of my, mm-hmm. the place where Trump, who he calls daddy, and he have just way too much in common. You know, like, this right. is amazing. I'm going to be bigger and better than ever. Like, all press. It's like the reality. Then it just tips into reality TV mm-hmm. at the end of the press conference.
I think he's incapable of making a clear statement. I also noticed on different videos or in different tapes, the name of the priest changed. You know, I mean, I don't really necessarily take it as an exact statement of truth. Sometimes it was kind of a poor joke. But in this big mess of a pretty dumb guy, just sort of spouting, being put in front of a microphone. Yeah, he said some things that were true and some things that were dumb. And that was the only thing that I've ever thought, oh, wow, he actually is making a point there. And it was what brought him down.
So is there any broader reason we care about this or care about him? So it seems to me like he'll disappear a little bit, or he'll become a darling of the right. Like, he'll become something different and possibly smaller than what he is now. But I do feel like there's a larger movement that women feminists should care about, which is this masculinity movement, this kind of big tent, which includes a version of gender relations, which I feel is more hostile to mm-hmm, women mm-hmm. And defines masculinity in a way which does include gay men of a certain kind, like not fey gay men, not straight men.
Who can't, you know.
Is he fey?
Oh, he's totally fey. I mean, he's a total bottom, and he screams that from the rooftops. And, like, again, that's a weird thing where there is this terrible tradition in gay culture of bottom shaming, and he's, you know, a proud queenie bottom. You know, again, it's all an act, you know, and those fucking frosted tips. But, he's a very femme gay man.
But Hannah, you're, I think, talking more about this guy, Jack Donovan, right? Who is another, I guess, leading light of the alt-right, who is also a gay man, but super butch?
Macho, yeah.
Macho. Macho's a way to put it.
Super mask.
Super mask. And he wrote this book called The Way of Men that has become sort of a text of what's known as the manosphere, which is kind of like the swirl of men's rights, Reddit, kind of like, we don't, no girls allowed. No girls allowed internet, basically, is what I would
and
call
a lot of hostility allowed. Like, it does channel.
Yeah.
Even though these guys think of themselves as the intellectuals, kind of redefining the boundaries of this and that, they do channel a huge number of angry, vicious trolls. So in that sense, it's not, you know, Milo thinks he's playing a game. Jack Donovan's a philosopher. But the people who they empower are not fun for women. You know?
Yeah, I guess I am interested in the fact that this, like, we wouldn't have been paying as much attention to this if Hillary had gotten elected.
Right.
That is true.
Right.
But it is a reaction against, you know, the perceived scolding of the PC left. And that's a real thing that, you know, I feel sometimes when someone writes in and scolds me for saying something incorrectly on this podcast, and I reckon with it and I hope I try to listen. But I think there's a very natural human reaction that is the opposite one. And that's why I think we should be paying attention in some ways to these men and like what why so many people are cottoning on to what they say.
I have just come around completely to thinking that in this moment when we have a president who says that the press is the enemy, which is an authoritarian tendency, I think the left reaction of shutting people down, like stopping people from talking as opposed to protesting what they're saying, is wrong. It's just another I've just come around to this recently. I just feel like it's not the right. You can, if people at Berkeley had let Milo Yiannopoulos speak and then sort of bum rushed him in as he was speaking or protested in the usual way, I think that would have been a lot better than shutting down his speaking. I think the shutting down of words has become the wrong strategy because this is an era where our president is trying to do just that. And we absolutely should not mimic it. Like if Hillary had been president, I would feel differently. It'd be a different conversation, but she's not president. And the right reaction, reaction is not to keep people from saying things. It's just not like we have to uphold a different side of it. And then the last thing I'm going to say about this man stuff, let's just we all decide, the three of us, to keep our eye on it, because I'm not so sure it's a fringe thing. I think it goes along with this new idea rising. That's partly misogyny, but it's partly also this kind of tribal politics that you see all over Breitbart. You know, everybody should be in their tribe. It's kind of essentialist. It's about the essential nature of the human being, and women are like this and men are like this, and the different tribes should stay in their corners. Like, this is the animating philosophy of the right now, that's having traction, that's kind of, you know, the brains behind the hatred or the emotion. And so anyway, I just am keeping my eye on it and seeing how much traction it gets, this man stuff.
I think you're right, but also just on tribalism, this is a slightly different point, but tribalism exists on the left too. A lot of what we've been doing over the last few years is, you know, identity politics, obviously, and identity politics is a form of tribalism. It's identifying yourself by a group, and it's, you know, it's appealing to everyone across the political spectrum. It's just done differently on both sides.
But it's, I mean, it, on the left, I think it is more about building coalitions and, you know, intersectionalism.
They sure built a coalition on the right, though,
too.
No, it's just like a coalition of hate for the most part.
Yeah.
Okay, we've talked a lot. We'll keep talking about these subjects, but let's wrap it up. Listeners, if you have thoughts about Milo, some of your thoughts are like, why are you guys talking about him? Bring him on. We'll accept him. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, Girls, in its sixth and final season, still presided over by Lena Dunham. She plays the grandiose and petty Hannah Horvath, who, when we meet her again, has just written a modern love column about her best friend getting together with her boyfriend. I love that opening, by the way. I thought that was just perfect. Like, I'm sure y'all who live in Brooklyn, like, that's a phenomenon that happens. Like, someone writes a modern love and then a bunch of people around town are like pissed off and, you know, that's not my truth or whatever. It was just great. Like, it just allowed them to introduce reintroduce into the new season every character in reaction to Hannah's column. It was very tidy and very excellent.
It was
an opening.
It was awesome. And I love too that I think it's every writer's fantasy that people read their work and then have these like faces of ecstasy. Like, oh my God, that transformed me. I'm so proud to know her. Like, Yes, that's how everybody reacts to everything they see of mine.
Now, Noreen, I remember in past conversations about girls, I think about this a lot, that you felt it a little too under the skin. I often think about that because I don't, because it's not my generation. So I mean, I'm a big fan and I just enjoy it. It's, you know, better or worse, like lots of different things I like about it. And we'll get to it. But you like the millennial narcissism, the kind of unbearable whiteness, the Brooklyn-y, like it all was kind of too much for you. Do you feel more distance from it now than you did when you first started watching?
I do. That's so funny you said that. I had this whole thing prepped about how I do. I feel like I grew up more than Hannah did over the, you know, the past few years. I've always thought that the people who really love girls are people who are not of that generation.
Yeah.
Because what she is doing is satirizing it. And when I watched Girls for the first time, I was, you know, in my mid-20s in my, like, Williamsburg apartment with my roommate, like, trying to be a writer. And, yeah, obviously I did not have much distance from that show. But I think it's become clearer over the seasons that, it's become clearer how transformative the show actually was, and, B, it's become... I think the initial, like, conflation of Lena Dunham with Hannah Horvath has cooled off, and certainly for me has cooled off. And so I can, I think, appreciate it more. I will always, you know, have various quibbles with it. I wouldn't be a good millennial in Brooklyn if I didn't. That's like a sport, you know, is like you knock on girls. But yeah, my girl's journey, it's really complete. And I went back and watched a couple episodes of season one, and they were better than I remember.
Yeah. There was this, that's the thing for me that I recognize that completely. Like, I'm definitely a different generation from her. And it's really easy for me to, like, look back with, you know, this sort of hazy glow on, oh, what it is to find yourself and that sort of carefree period of figuring yourself out.
Well, but it's not carefree. It's not carefree on the show. It actually, that's one thing that I do like about it, is that it shows how painful that can be and what an asshole many people are along the way. And I do like the journey. I like the progression that a number of characters have had. In particular, Shoshana. Can we just, like...
Yeah,
pour one out for Shoshana, who was secretly the best one all along and is in full flower as the best girl in this final season.
You know, the thing that I've always been so impressed with, I think because I am older, is just the way that Lena Dunham is able to see what it's like to be young while she's still young. Like, she sees now what I see, you know, 30 years later,
well,
or 25 years later.
Well, that's because she didn't really live that life, though, right?
Right.
Like, she had, you know, at 24 or whatever, she had a film at Sundance that was super successful. So
yeah.
It was more like close observation of people who are numerically her peers, not in many other ways. And so that's, I mean, if you want to get into my quibbles, sometimes I felt like it actually relied on, like, you know, it was too far. It was like the mediated version of millennials, like the kind of version you might construct after reading some trend pieces. But, you know,
yeah.
What are you going to do?
What do you think about the conflation of Hannah Horvath and Lena Dunham, which is to some extent justified, to some extent completely unjustified? Where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes from people not being terribly good at decoding things, and the fact that she was fearless and had Hannah say and do things that were dumb, and then she, in as Lena Dunham said and did, some things that were dumb, not the same things. And so I think people kind of put the two things on top of each other when they're actually separate.
Well, and so first of all, this always happens when women tell a story. But I think it's in some ways fair. Like, she encouraged it. You know, you would read an article about Lena Dunham having OCD, and then
put a Q-tip in her ear.
Right. And the next season of Girls featured a storyline that sort of went away about Hannah Horvath having OCD. So obviously she was drawing from life, and it's impossible not to draw those connections. But it is like it's like the version of Lena. It's like the worst version of Lena Dunham that she put on screen, or so I've extrapolated. And that's what's interesting to me, is like her real world persona has actually really changed over the last few years. She's become very earnest and very, you know, politically active. And And yet she's got this side of her that remains this cruel satirist. And I sort of feel like that's the realer Lena Dunham or something. But that is, you know, fan fiction on my part.
I want to hear from you, Hannah, because I...
Yeah, I mean, okay, let me run my... I have two theories that I came up with in thinking about this. One is, so there was a lot of criticism of the show for its unbearable whiteness after the first season, which she somewhat responded to. And I was thinking about the unbearable whiteness of the show. She has an interview with Judd Apatow in the New York Times, which I loved for many, many reasons, mostly in its depiction of their mentorship. But one of the things she says is, I started this show. Now, everyone of that that generation says that, which is like, I didn't see my truth reflected on television. Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted to start this show. So that's interesting. And I think that's the reason I like the show, because it feels like the particular vision of a particular person. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like the studios wrote a script and then a bunch of young people are acting in it. It does feel like authentic in some sense. And because the show is so successful, when I think about the shows I have loved best in the last couple years, it's Atlanta, Donald Glover's show, mm-hmm. and Aziz Ansari's show. And I think it's for the same reason. The two of them probably went into it thinking they're both very particular people with particular visions of the world. And I think both of them probably went to the studios and said, look, I don't see myself or my mind reflected on TV, and I'm going to star in this, I'm going to write this, and I'm going to make this happen, sort of like Lena Dunham did. And so I think, do you think Girls had anything to do with that type of show becoming acceptable in the TV world? Like that people liked it, took those risks, basically.
Yeah, but I think also it's a huge amount to do with the way that television is changing. You know,
don't you think Girls changed a lot of television? I actually am willing to give it a lot more credit than I would have even a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not the only one, because again, with HBO, you know, what's success? Like, the audience isn't huge, but it certainly got a lot of buzz. It probably drove some subscribers for HBO, which is the ultimate test for HBO. You know, I think Louis is also a huge factor.
Yeah, that's another one.
And certainly, you know, the path from Louis to Atlanta, I think, is maybe easier to see than Girls to Atlanta. But yeah, I think it's definitely, I mean, yeah, there's no doubt, not only in terms of what the companies that commission these shows are looking for and what they are expecting, you know, and they're not going to cancel them if they don't get, you know, a 3 rating in the demo or whatever. But they... I think, too, that it is, you know, I've sat in rooms with creative people and, like, broken down episodes of Girls and, like, how did she do that? And I think it does, some people find it inspiring on a sort of, like, the building blocks of it basis, in the way that they might also, or other people might find that in Master of None or Atlanta or Louis or... Many of
Insecure is another one, by the way. That's the Issa Rae show, like, where you really feel her imprint all over that show. You know, mm-hmm. how it's written, how she stars in it. Like, you just feel like one person is driving the show, and it's not a studio head. You know, it's mm-hmm. not like Mary Tyler Moore, where they, like, wrote up the thing because they read it in the Trend magazine, and then they found a cute actress to, you know, embody it. It's like somebody's driving that train completely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I do think, just thinking about Insecure, the race conversation has always been an important one about Girls. You know, there was an initial spate of articles about how white Girls was, and in some ways that opened the door to an awareness of just how, I mean, obviously there have been lots of articles before that set of articles about Girls, about how white Hollywood is and how white television is. But it did get people thinking about individual stories. I will say that on the critique of the Girls of Girls being too white, like, those girls, I think Wesley Morris said this in his piece in The Times, but, like, part of what is, like, true to their environment is those kind of are the girls who would only be friends with white people, mm-hmm. perhaps, or only friends with people like them, you know? And so it's true to the environment. But Lena Dunham has said, you know, if I were doing the show even a couple of years later, I wouldn't have made them all white. It's just like you can see over the 6 seasons of the show how identity politics has changed for the better. And now we live in a world where HBO is psyched to promote Issa Rae in the way that they are.
Well, and it's funny, too, that in the second episode of season 6, she has an interaction where you see she's sort of commenting herself. I mean, like, she runs into Joy Bryant, who was great in Good Girls Revolt, in a, you know, and she's almost literally a magical woman of color. Mm. You know, she like gives her
the
magical
is the woman
tea set
in the Flea.
Yeah,
okay.
And it's, you know, I mean, I think we can have, you know, knowing our understanding of Lena Dunham, we can absolutely give her credit for having her character run into this, you know, oh my goodness, I don't know any real black people, but here's a magical Negro for my character to run into. You know, I mean, it's she's commenting on that. And I think, yeah, she did set, you know, maybe not intentionally, but she did set balls a-moving.
Yeah. And now, you know, executives probably read those think pieces about how Girls was too white, and like maybe they were just doing to check boxes, or maybe they actually like gave a chance to people who they might not have given a chance to before. And the result is really interesting TV, I would say.
Yeah.
And let a lot of young people basically just write their own shows and took risks on them.
Yeah.
Since we're soon going to talk about Silicon Valley, I just want to say another thing about that Judd Apatow article. It was so, their model of mentorship is so interesting because he's taken a lot of shit for being, you know, sexist and writing his women characters as shrill over the years and the men as lovable, etc. But the way he, there's this one line in that interview where he says he told her early on, like, I'm going to give you, that he took the power struggle, he intentionally took the power struggle out of their relationship by saying, I'm going to give you suggestions, I'm going to weigh in, but we're going to say from the start that the decision is ultimately yours. So there's no struggle here. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, that's just thoughtful. I don't know if it's thoughtful about the way women work, or I don't know if it's thoughtful about the way Hollywood works, or if he just was speaking to what he thought would work with her or what would make a good product. But I thought it was an interesting twist in the usual Hollywood relationship, which was obviously successful, and they seem genuinely close.
So to bring things back to Milo in a way, there's a scene in the first episode where Hannah is at surf camp on assignment, not doing the assignment, and she gets so messy drunk, and it's kind of magnificent because she's basically like vomiting as she's drinking and just like spewing booze as she is writhing around on the floor, and it's such, it's almost like a sort of gift wrapped sort of present to those hideous men who like nothing more than to make fun of her and people who look like her. But she did that. Like, is she serving up outrage? Like, is it sort of prepackaged outrage for the people who are minded to do that?
The troll aspect of Lena Dunham is something we haven't really discussed because she herself has been hit with so many trolls. But like,
so many.
She, you know, she will deliberately. There's been so much discussion about her body, mm-hmm. and she actually isn't that big. She described her body once as very specific, which I think is a very good description of it. But she puts herself in unflattering outfits. She shoots herself from unflattering angles. She's daring people mm-hmm. to be critical of her. And I think that's such an interesting part of her psychology. And that is what rubs people the wrong way about the show and about her, or you know, that you're sitting there having to think about, you know, Lena Dunham's breasts when instead of the plot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's doing it almost as a performance art thing. Like, what do you think about women's bodies? Why are you so obsessed with them, et cetera, et cetera. But it can be distracting. I you know, I think it's awful when people say horrible things about her body. But just like within the show, it is sometimes distracting because you're like, why did she put on that romper? Is it just to dare us to talk about how bad it looks? Like, yeah, that seems like the reason why she did it.
Yeah, I like when she does that because I think it actually works. Mm-hmm. Like it is like it is a kind of in your face, different kind of body that is purposely not looking great. Like that's good. Mm-hmm. Who does that? Nobody does that. Everyone, no matter what size they are, is always like looking really good. You know?
Yeah, it's courageous. It actually is courageous. Yeah. I would not be able to do the same thing, and I admire her for that.
She has expanded the range of bodies that are the range of types of bodies that are seen on television. But I do sometimes think, why, Lena? Why are you trolling, or are you trolling the trolls? Like, how many levels of trolling are going on here? Or are you just making a beautiful show?
She just wants us to have this conversation, yeah. I think. Yeah, she wants people to think in a serious way about why they have that kind of reaction.
Like Milo, she's a provocateur. In her case, of provocateurs.
So let's move on to our third topic,
Sexism at Uber. This weekend, a former engineer at Uber, Susan Fowler, wrote a personal blog post, which she called One Very, Very Strange Year at Uber. It opens on her first day with her manager, I guess the manager of her team, propositioning her, essentially, telling her that he was in an open relationship and essentially implying, as she says, that he wants to have sex with her. Then it continues through her year where she makes various complaints to HR, and those complaints are ignored because of people's, basically, they're good performers. And so HR keeps flicking her away. And she eventually left, and so did lots of other women who started with her at Uber. Is what she says. So you should all go read her blog post. And to discuss it with us today is Natasha Tiku, who covers tech for BuzzFeed. Hi, Natasha.
Hey.
So I will say, like, if you read the blog post, it's a lot of, like, truthiness. Like, it seems like something that could happen at Silicon Valley. So what stood out to you? Like, what stood out to you as notable about the various claims that she makes?
I mean, I think so much of it sounded familiar in terms of a company that, you know, uses HR more to protect the company, that doesn't believe, you know, I guess tries to marginalize a woman's concerns. But I think part of the reason that the truthiness, like, that it comes across so unimpeachable is because she is such a perfect representation of an employee. I mean, she goes over, you know, how her performance reviews were perfect. She went to Stanford. She's in a very hard kind of engineering background. I think all of those things are what predisposed people to taking her claims more seriously than perhaps some other women in tech who have made similar claims in the past.
And also, just there is this terrible lack of women in engineering that, you know, at companies like Uber or Facebook or Google, they tend to be this kind of 15%, 17% kind of ratio. But at smaller companies, it's more like 6%. So they're just, we know just from those numbers that this is an issue in the tech sector, right?
Oh, certainly, yes. Like, so in the past few years, companies like Facebook and Google and Twitter have been putting out transparency reports about their breakdown, gender-wise, race-wise, ethnicity, both in technical and non-technical aspects of their workforce. And that was actually a hard-won transparency. They didn't initially want to make those figures public. But because of that, we've seen not only that the percentages are so low, but also that in the time that they've been transparent about it, it hasn't really been changing at all.
One of the things I thought was most interesting about her blog post was she describes her manager essentially changing her performance review after it's been submitted, the result being that she no longer had sort of the numbers necessary to transfer to the team that she wanted to transfer for to. And she heard him later bragging about how he still had a woman on his team. So he'd essentially, her implication there was that he'd essentially, like, purposefully misrepresented her performance in order to keep her on his team, thus upping his own, like, diversity quotient and helping his own performance, which is just crazy.
Yeah, that is one of the most insidious and kind of ridiculous parts of it. The other part I think that stood out to a lot of people was the leather jacket part, where leather jackets were ordered for the 120 male engineers and the women who had actually, you know, been sized and had their proper female sizes for leather jackets were told they wouldn't get any because they got a discount on the male engineer jackets and didn't have one on the female sizes. And when Susan complained, she was told that if female engineers were concerned about equality, they wouldn't want the jackets because they didn't get the same discounted price. And I mean, on the one hand, it's obviously really ridiculous. But on the other hand, like, this is, I mean, I think it's something that sounds familiar to a lot of tech people where you get, like, free T-shirts and a lot of free things. And it's all kind of standardized towards a stereotypical male employee.
I have so many extra large T-shirts from my time at Microsoft.
But it's exactly. Like the whole thing feels like HR circa 1984. Like, what is up with the tech world, the way they respond? Is it what I just didn't understand what I was missing here is like, is Uber especially sexist, or is it just that the Silicon Valley HR companies prioritize performance to such a degree that that's all they look at? So they just keep hoping these problems are going to go away. Like, what's the fundamental blind spot here that they have?
Right. I mean, I think that that HR is the fundamental blind spot for sure. You know, in a way, Uber kind of personifies that the startup ethos in that, like, you know, you will cut corners and make sacrifices in order to grow. And there's a really good report in Recode about how Uber's HR was not only, you know, it was all about hiring and recruiting. That was the central thrust of their HR department. And that's partly what leads to a problem where, you know, when people come to you with the kinds of problems they might have at a $69 billion company or, you know, even a $100 million company, a $10 million company, and you don't treat them seriously because your objective is growth above all else.
Dan Gross had a good piece in Slate on Tuesday where essentially he said, look, Uber is somewhat sociopathic by design. The whole point of the company is to kind of shatter norms. That's what they're organized around. And so we shouldn't be surprised if the company philosophy is, you know, smash it all and start over if they don't really pay attention to norms in the workplace. You know, they're going to do what's, you know, follow the legal guidelines, probably, maybe. But that's, you know, the whole ethos is about making change.
Right. But I mean, I think we should be surprised when it is a company that plans to go public in 2018.
Yeah.
You know, when it's raised the amount of money that it has in debt and equity, when it has the valuation that it has. I mean, the person who's working in HR now, she sat in on meetings with Travis and other top executives where they discussed, you know, potential risks. There's a risk section in your SEC filing when you go public. And so, you know, we don't need to rely, like, companies are not supposed to rely on their own, like, moral sense of goodness in order to behave properly. They're supposed to just follow the law.
How much do people care about the fact that only 3% or 6% of Uber's engineers are women? Like, did people not care until this blog post came out, essentially? Like, is it a problem at other companies with a similar ratio if they haven't had, you know, a viral complaint against them?
Well, I think one of the reasons that this post went viral and maybe other posts by women who have also talked about their own experiences with sexism and gender harassment at tech companies haven't is because Susan worked in as a site reliability engineer, and that's like considered a tough engineering department and specialization. And the fact that she was so, that all of her performance reviews were perfect and she clearly was such a great employee, I think, you know, kind of undermined the usual response to concerns about the lack of female engineers, which is that I from everyone I've talked to, I think there's a genuine belief that, you know, women really aren't as predisposed to engineering. They don't have, you know, some of the hard science background. They don't have the cutthroat, like clear logic that it takes. They have, you know, you hear that over and over again. And I think that, you know, it's sort of like partly why I think Trump appeals to, at least his candor appeals to a certain swath of Silicon Valley, because I think it's that sort of thing where they don't feel like they can say it, but come on, everybody knows. They're not going to lower their standards to have more women. Like, please, you know, these are very important companies that have huge technical problems.
So it's no problem if you're trying to go public with a company that's 6% women, essentially.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that that's considered an issue. I mean, certainly they haven't. You know, Facebook, Google, none of these places even put out their transparency reports until after they went public. And even then, I mean, I think the concern in the risk section is not that, you know, you lose out when you don't have a diverse workforce and people inputting diverse ideas that appeal to a diverse customer base. It's just that, you know, they might get sued because what they're doing is clearly unfair.
So, okay, just a last thing. Doesn't it depress you then? I mean, when you read someone like Susan Fowler, like she, you know, she behaved above board at every turn. She reported things to HR. Like she did exactly, you know, she has an impeccable performance. You couldn't get anyone better, really, to expose some of the stuff. And yet, you know, it didn't work out for her. Like she couldn't last in one of these companies because it was just too unpleasant and toxic, as it was for so many of the people that she started out with. I mean, she says something like it was in the 20s. I can't remember the exact number, but it dropped precipitously the percentage of total employees who were women. So doesn't it just feels a little hopeless? Like if she can't make it happen, who's going to make it happen? Or do you have some little like spark of hope for us here about women in this industry?
I don't. In fact, I have, sorry to your report, but I mean, the thing that depressed me even more was seeing how women of color and women who've been in the situation and don't have that unimpeachable record responded to it. You know, they were just like, this happens all the time. And I think there was a layer of frustration about why Susan's case got so much attention. And I mean, I think that's partly to do with the same reason that Delete Uber got so much attention. There is a buildup of ill will and suspicion about this company. But I think the depressing thing is just how common it is. And when you think about all of the women who weren't able to say that they had a perfect record and still had valid complaints, that's what's really frustrating to think about.
All right. Well, on that sad note, thank you for joining us. I hope we're going to have you back, but it's going to be on a like, yay, women in Silicon Valley. We just got to find one somewhere to give us a teeny bit of hope in
the
future.
They're coming out. Yeah. They're very strong and built. They'll change it eventually. Yeah.
Okay, awesome. That's a good note. Well, thank you, Natasha, and keep doing the good work. We depend on you to cover the industry in ways that we can, you know, relate to.
Okay, thanks, guys.
All right, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I have two. One is a novel called Private Citizens by Tony. I'm going to butcher his last name. Tony Tulathamute, I think, is something approximate to what it is. I picked it up because New York Magazine's book critic called it the first great millennial novel.
Wow.
And I liked it a lot. I don't know that I would call it the first great millennial novel, but I was completely absorbed by it. It's a story of four friends who have just graduated from Stanford.
So like girls, except with Stanford. No.
And it's like girls, except with Stanford. And there are men in the group of four. And there are people of color in the group of four.
Which one's Carrie? No, I can't stop now.
It is not a glamorous story. It's sort of like life becomes weirdly hard for them because they are self-destructive. It's somewhat acrid toward the characters. Like it gets very dark very quickly, but he is a really good writer. Like he's really funny. His sentences are fantastic. And so it's just worth it on a sentence level alone. And I'm really excited to see what he does in the future as a writer. And then the second thing is pure soapy fun on HBO, Big Little Lies. I've watched a few episodes. I got my hands on some screeners and I couldn't be more into it. It's that Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman,
Laura Dern,
Shailene Woodley. It's just like if you like, I don't know, if you like The Affair, that kind of television, if you like any kind of social satire, kind of parlor room drama with a little murder, it's great. It's just like Reese Witherspoon is almost campy, but not like, and Nicole Kidman gives a really good performance in this really what you learn is a twisted role. And I'm so into it.
It's awesome. I can't wait. I was going to watch it last night and then I fell asleep and I just can't wait. So I'm really, it's in my queue.
I love it.
Okay, I am so the opposite, and I'm really sorry. I'm a bit of a downer in my recommendations this week. I kind of went from Milo Yiannopoulos into kind of a deep mansplainy hole. Has that ever happened to you guys, where you just suddenly find yourself in a world of Superman splainers? I'm about to come out of it, so I won't do this next time, but I started reading that book Homo Deus by Yuval Harari, and it's like caveman, cyborgs. His blurbs are from Obama and Bill Gates. He's like this Israeli philosopher I don't even know if he's a philosopher, but he just like explains the giant universe and like all the trends, and he's a vegan, and it's just this broad, broad, like Jared Diamond-y view of the world. And then I kind of backed into Sam Harris, who has this podcast called Waking Up, which is also very mansplainy philosophical debates with other professors. Anyway, I'll stop soon, but it is, I was trying to think about why I fell into this hole, which is so rare. And I think it's because these big, broad, it kind of takes you out of the political moment. You know, it's like the equivalent of your mom saying like, oh, this is just a moment. It will pass, honey. Like, get some perspective. So it's allowed me to just see the world like from, you know, 10,000 feet up. Uh-huh. So I don't feel so stuck in this tiny little moment, because otherwise I really can't explain what I'm doing. But every night I open Homo Deus and I'm like, ooh, agricultural society, you know, the Black Plague, cyborgs, AI. Wow. And also, why don't women write like that? Like, why can't you find a woman? You know, even Martha Nussbaum, like, we do have our public philosophers, but they're mostly talking about intimate stuff. Like, it's rare to find a woman who writes on that kind of, I'm going to explain all of history and the entire universe to you in one book. That's really, really heavy.
Because women aren't assholes.
Thank you, Noreen. Thank you. Now it's time for me to stop. June, you go.
Mine is, talk about contrast. My recommendation is, so Barbara Hale died on January 26th. She was 94. And I don't know if people are recognizing that name, but she played Della Street, Perry Mason's confidential secretary, and I think kind of sort of girlfriend for many, many years. And I think my response to these crazy times that we live in was to then start to watch a lot of really old Perry Mason episodes. I got the CBS All Access so I could watch The Good Fight, which may or may not be a mistake. I'm not quite convinced that it's worth it, but it's worth it for Perry Mason because they have like the first five seasons. And back then, seasons were like 39 episodes or something crazy like that. And Barbara Hale as Della Street is so magnificent. She's like, she's a great helpmeet, and she's very, like, she's the secretary, yes, because that was the role that she had back then. But she's so fantastic, and she really, she, at the end of every episode, pretty much, she and Perry have like a little button, a little moment, and it's always just so good. And she was a fantastic actress. And so I now want to be Della Street, but not to be a confidential secretary, but so good. So Perry Mason and Della Street.
I love Perry Mason.
Awesome. Thank you for the correction to my tediosity. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to our producer, Vera Lynn Williams, the executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page to find out more information about the show, to read about our recommendations, is slate.com/XX. Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, for you guys to talk amongst yourselves, yell at us, praise us, and send us recommendations for what we should talk about. Or you can email us, which many of you do. Thank you to XXGabFest@slate.com. Please subscribe on iTunes or any place where you get your podcasts, and leave a comment so other people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and I will talk to you again in 2 weeks. Oh, that's not a funny joke, but it makes me laugh every time.